I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will be back on Monday, and this is Your Call. I don't work in museums because I love them. I love the promise of what they can be. I work in museums because I hate schools and see museums as a viable alternative. I'm a strong believer in free choice learning, and I see museums as places to circumvent the hazards of compulsory education and to support a democratic, engaged society of learners. Those are the words of our guest, Nina Simon, on her blog Museum 2.0, where she explores how radical educational thought and the philosophy of Web 2.0 can be applied in museums to make them more engaging, more community-based, vital elements of society. And it's that vision she's put into action in her first year and a half as executive director of the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History. In that time, attendance at the museum has more than doubled due to a new participatory approach to culture that invites visitors to become actively involved in creating exhibitions and programs. And on Your Call today, we're going to talk about the purpose of museums, what they're here for, what they've been, what they could be, and how we should interact with them as people who come into them and enjoy them. We're going to want you to join the conversation, but I'm very glad to welcome Nina Simon here on Your Call. Nina, congratulations on your work, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Matt. It's a pleasure.
And we definitely want to hear from listeners whether you're someone who loves museums, who is goes to them all the time, has cherished them throughout your life, or whether you're someone who's never quite felt welcome to museums. We want to hear your ideas for keeping them as living cultural institutions that welcome all kinds of people to them. The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. If you have had an experience of museums you found really remarkable, that has maybe opened up your ideas of what can happen in a museum, we'd love to hear from you. And as I say, if you're someone who's felt left out in museums, talk about why that is and how you might want to see things change. The number to call, 866-798-TALK. And if you prefer to write rather than to call, you can always send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Nina, you have been thinking and writing about museums for a long time. You launched your Museum 2.0 blog in 2006. You wrote your book, The Participatory Museum, not long after that. But then a year and a half ago, May of 2011, you actually got to run a museum when you became executive director of the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History. Talk about what you've done in that time and what it's been like, some examples of how you tried to put these ideas that you're so passionate about into action.
Sure. Well, Matt, when I came to the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History in 2011, it was in a situation that a lot of museums are facing. A traditional museum with solid exhibitions, educational programs, and a small group of people in our community who knew and loved it, and a large group of people in our community who had never heard of it. And so we really said, okay, if we're going to become this thriving central gathering place that's in our vision statement, we need to change the relationship people have with this museum. It can't just be a place that they come on a school field trip or that they come once every few years when somebody's in town. It has to be a place that's really a part of their lives. And so when I think about our museum and the idea of art and history, we have to present those things not as something that somebody else did that's on a wall for you to learn about, but something that you can really be involved in. Everybody has art as part of their lives, whether they're being creative and making work on their own or whether it's the posters they put on their wall. Everybody has history as part of their lives, whether it's the things their grandmother brought over to this country or the personal stories they have in their experiences in our community. And so I feel like what we've tried to do is say, okay, let's connect with people through the ways that they experience art and history, and let's create and design ways for their stories, their creative activities, to really be showcased and be part of the museum. And that doesn't mean just putting visitors' stuff on display, although we do sometimes do that. It means really designing ways for them to participate and to create something larger than themselves. So, for example, we just did a project that concluded with what we called memory jars, where we had a room with floor-to-ceiling mason jars, and we said, we want to create a collection of Santa Cruz memories. So bottle up a favorite memory, use some craft materials, and put them together in this jar, write your story on the outside of the jar, and put it on the wall. And we ended up with over 800 different memories on display in this space. Incredibly poignant and sad memories of people who had died, memories of great experiences, just little tiny memories, memories of going to church as a kid and getting lost, or memories of going to the beach and building a sandcastle bigger than yourself. That kind of experience experience allows people not only to create something in the museum, but to see that their story and their experience is part of this much bigger story of what we as a community remember, what we share, and what we honor when we think about the objects and the stories that should be in a museum.
I mean, when you give that example, I mean, that sounds like an amazing thing. And I bet a lot of people came into that not knowing what they were going to expect from coming to a museum and maybe going out with something different than they'd expected. But how does that relate to kind of what we think of as the kind of traditional purposes of museum, to show you, oh, here's beautiful art, or to say, here's important history you need to know about your community or your country, or here, you know, here's some scientific information that you can engage with and go away understanding the natural world better. How does that kind of interactivity you're talking about, where people who come to the museum are generating something from their experiences, connect to that traditional vision?
You know, what I've seen both at our museum in Santa Cruz and in projects I've done throughout the world is that these kinds of participatory experiences help people make a better connection on exactly what you're talking about. So when you, for example, create a representation of a memory, it changes the way you then look at our history gallery and you think about the memories and the stories of people who are not like you, who are in our community. Or when you participate in co-creating a piece of art, say a sculpture, it changes the way that you look at the process of art making and the way you think about the artist and the work that you see on the wall. I think, unfortunately, for a lot of people, when you walk into a museum, you see somebody else's stuff, somebody else's story, somebody else's creation. And I think that by inviting people to participate, it really changes that equation and helps people not necessarily say, well, I'm as good as that famous artist, but to say, I get a little glimpse of what it's like to be creative, or what it's like to solve a tough problem, what it's like to invent something. And that makes me be more empathetic and more interested in these bigger stories, or these more codified stories, or, you know, sanctioned artists who are on display.
Now, talk a little bit about that idea of people coming into a museum and having a sense, this is stuff created by, or understood by, or put together by somebody else. I mean, obviously, some people feel more excluded or more, you know, like this is not me being represented here than others. Talk about the ways you see traditional museums having left people out or making them feel like they don't belong there.
Yeah, well, you know, that happens on so many different levels, whether it's an expectation of how quiet or loud you're supposed to be in a museum. You know, there are all kinds of secret rules of a museum. Can you touch things? Can you not touch things? Especially in a world where there are museums with interactivity, it can be very hard to figure out, how am I supposed to decode this experience? If I'm here with my kids, what are they allowed to do and what are they not allowed to do?
Yeah.
And there is a real sense for people who've been to museums for a long time, we've internalized those rules. But for new people, it can be very mysterious, just like, you know, I'm Jewish, and I always remember when you bring a friend to a temple, there are these times during a Jewish ceremony where people stand up. And to a person who's new, it's very mysterious. Why are we standing up now? Why are we sitting down now? And I think there's a lot of that that happens in museums. But I think in a broader sense also, when you think about the content on the wall, there is often a sense of designing museum exhibitions to be at hand's length. You know, you think about those labels that are written in this third-person, encyclopedic kind of voice. There is no person behind that label. There's this whole sense that we're going to anesthetize this story so we can be as objective as possible and as accurate as possible. And sometimes that leads to situations where something that is very emotionally charged, whether it's an artwork or historic artifact, really loses that quality. I mean, you might remember a few years ago, there was a whole controversy about displaying the Enola Gay at the Smithsonian in Washington. And there was this whole question about what should the label say? And I think it's very hard to imagine that we could, in 50 words, on a label in third person, tell the story of all the emotions and all the different perspectives on an object like that. And so from my perspective, instead of saying, well, let's try and figure out what that encyclopedic arm-length story is, let's find ways to invite people to participate, to share their own perspectives, to share their own stories, and to do so with a curatorial eye, just as journalism works, so that we really think about ways to have multiple voices at the table and to not be saying, this is the voice of God and you are just here to receive it.
That's Nina Simon. She is the director of the Santa Cruz Museum for Art and History, also the creator of the Museum 2.0 blog. This is Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who's going to be back on Monday. And we are talking about museums, what they're for, what they've been, what they might become, and hearing some of Nina's ideas about this. We want to hear yours as well. Give us a call at 866-798-8888. 8255. If there's just a really remarkable interactive or participatory museum experience you've had, we'd love to hear about it. If you're one of those people Nina's talking about who may feel like they don't know the rules of the museum, or they haven't felt like they've been initiated into them and therefore don't necessarily feel comfortable in museums as they are, what would make you feel more welcome? The number to call, 866-798-8255. And speaking of some of the barriers to people feeling like they can come to museums, I know Harry in San Francisco has a comment to make about that. Harry, welcome to your call.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to say that used to be all the museums in Golden Gate Park were free, and people could make a day of going to one or the other. Now they're prohibitively expensive. In addition, there's a policy I've seen, both at some city-run institutions and other places, of charging people who are not from the area more money than the people who are local, so everyone is forced to show an ID to go to a museum. And to me, this has a kind of chilling effect, and especially the high costs of entering the museums are really prohibitive for most people, I think. And it's kind of like, you know, if you're the upper class, you're able to go to the museum. Otherwise, forget it. And I was wondering if your guest had any
thoughts
about that.
I noticed she does.
She's charging an affordable $5. So,
Nina, you want to weigh in there?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for sharing that, Harry. I think, you know, it's very interesting to think about this question of, should museums be public services like the library, where you can stop in anytime, get a dose of art or history? Or should they be like entertainment or recreational venues, like, say, going to a theme park or going to a movie, where you're pricing for the market? And there are different museums making different choices. I feel, frankly, from an ethical perspective, if we are going to be community-serving organizations, we have to be places that are not only affordable, but that really invite people to feel like they can be part of that place and be part of that community. Sometimes that can involve paying a little bit of money, you know, that you invest a little bit and have a little bit of community ownership. But if there's that means test when you walk in the door, can I afford that? It really not only makes people feel that it's for somebody else, but also there are people who might be inclined or interested or intrigued, but they can't even tell what's beyond that door. Is it worth $10? Is it worth $20? I don't know that. You know, one of the things I'm really proud of that we've been doing in Santa Cruz at our museum is a policy we call spontaneous free. And this means that if you walk in the museum and you're sort of looking around and you basically don't pull out your wallet and give us $5, if you're sort of clearly weighing whether this is a good idea for you, we just make up a reason and invite you in. We say, oh, is it your first time here? Be our guest. Come on in. Or, oh, you're an artist? It's free for you. We just make it up. And our goal is just to make people feel welcome. And if they've gotten in the door, we don't want to stop them from having that experience because they're not going to pay $5. We want to welcome them in. We want to invite them in. And hopefully some of those people will feel like, gosh, this is something I really want to support with my dollars. And some of them will feel like, gosh, I feel really welcome and invited to be part of this because that obstruction was taken away from me.
We got an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org from Josh, who says, hello, I've been living and working with community projects in downtown Santa Cruz for over a decade. I noticed when Nina was hired, I feel personally engaged by the museum. The MAH has reached out to projects and individuals to get them and us involved. Thank you. It's great. Well, thank you, Josh, for the email. And I know, Nina, I mean, one of the things when you kind of talk about what has happened in the last year and a half at your museum, one of the things you talk about is doubling the number of people who are coming in the door. And obviously, as an institution, you want to have people coming, and you know that's part of your sense of service to the community and also helping you maintain your financial viability. But when it comes to measuring your success, in not just in terms of numbers, but in terms of what you're trying to achieve, which is really something bigger than just getting people in the door, how do you do that?
Sure. Well, you know, a lot of it speaks to what was inside Josh's email, was this extent to which we really think about partnerships in the community. And we don't think about those partnerships as being limited to other art or history or learning organizations. We really look at it and say, hey, if we want to be a community development organization, if we want to be a place where people can have difficult conversations in a safe space, what kinds of conversations do we need to be sparking? Who do we need to work with? So just tomorrow night, for example, we're working with the Second Harvest Food Bank to be able to come in to sell some food at the event to support their holiday food drive. You know, you may say, well, how is that part of a mission of a museum to help a food bank raise money? But hunger is a really important issue in Santa Cruz, and we want to help people understand that you need food for the body and food for the soul, and that a museum can be part of that. In the same way, we partner with the Homeless Service Center. We partner with all kinds of groups in our community that are sort of unlikely suspects to really be able to say, these are important community issues, and history has a bearing inspiring on how we got to where we are. Art helps us think about where we're going to go. We need to be engaged in these things. When it comes to increasing attendance, a lot of it comes through these partnerships. So, for example, if we do an event about the history and the art of Santa Cruz music, we're inviting in the Ukulele Club and the UCSC Opera Circle and the Guitar Makers and the Chorale. And all these different groups in Santa Cruz are then finding that the museum can be a place that celebrates and supports their work. And by the way, it gets them involved and invested in bringing their friends and their family in as well to say, hey, this is a place that isn't trying to show us something from outside and tell us that we can't, you know, live up to this. It's a place that really celebrates and connects with what is cultural and what is exciting in that way in Santa Cruz.
Well, Nina, so you're doing your work in Santa Cruz. You're at the studios of KUSP, our partners there. We're here in San Francisco in the middle of a larger metropolis. And I mean, is there some way that maybe, I mean, the Museum of Art and History in Santa Cruz, you can be a gathering place for a whole variety of things from the food bank onward that maybe in a bigger context might not make sense in the same way?
You know, that's a really interesting point, Matt, because I, you know, before I took this job, I was working around the world with different museums and mostly large ones in big cities. And I do think there's a difference. You know, if you are an SF MoMA or a De Young and you have an incredible collection and you're in a major urban area with an arts focus, there's a different role that museums naturally play in the community. People are already sort of aware of them, whether it's from banners around the streets or whether it's shows that are going up. There's a critical mass that really makes a more traditional museum more viable. But frankly, outside of San Francisco, New York, LA, just a few urban centers, most of the country and 99% of museums are not these giant museums with Matisse and with these huge blockbuster shows, and they have to have a different relationship. That said, if you look at what's happening with SF MoMA's transformation, you know, their language in terms of what they want to do is absolutely about community engagement in a new way. And I think that this kind of idea around participation is permeating everything from the smallest community organizations to some really large museums. You know, think about what happens if a large museum decides we're going to turn our garden into a community garden partnership with a homeless center, or we're going to turn our lecture series into an opportunity to really talk about social justice issues in our community. It could be incredible.
Well, I want to go to Laurel in San Francisco, who works at one of those institutions here in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on the show. Nina, I'm the youth arts manager here at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts and a former guest blogger on Museum 2.0 back when we piloted the YBCAU program. And I just want to thank you so much for all of your vital insights into the field. My question is about the embodied experience of the visitor. I think that as a performing arts organization as well as a visual arts organization, we conceptualize the body a lot at YBCA. But I'm curious about how the architecture and the design of the space can help the body of the visitor have a more engaged and alive experience rather than this sort of passive experience. I feel like a lot of visitors to museum are like, oh, my back hurts. Where can I sit down?
Things it's always like good that. To have a place to sit.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for calling in, Laurel. You know, I think that architecture absolutely matters. And YBCA is such an interesting story in that way because the whole Yerba Buena Gardens was designed to face in on the garden. And, of course, now that that area has become such a hopping area, it almost feels strange that you have, you know, that the gardens have their back to the city. And I think there's an opportunity to really figure out how do you open up to the street. But it's interesting, you know, over the last decade, there's been a huge movement towards what people often call starkitecture in museums, creating these works of art unto themselves in the building. But those works of art aren't necessarily designed to really welcome people to have a creative or an unusual experience in the space. What I've seen be really successful in some of those ways, first of all, finding ways to go over the top in being welcoming. You know, here at the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History, we have brightly painted chairs in our elevator. And when you hit the button and the elevator door opens and you see these ridiculous chairs, people just start laughing. And, you know, our approach is sort of, how can we go over the top in saying we want you to be comfortable here? Even in the elevator, we want to give you a creative, fun way to sit down. So there's that kind of thing. And then I also see, and it's somewhat related, a lot of museums working well with creating surprises. You know, at the Denver Art Museum, one of their most popular pieces is this incredible large sculpture of these foxes who have taken over a kind of cafe-ish setting, and it's set in a very unusual space in the museum, so you sort of come upon it and you're shocked. And I think that there is an extent to which we've created museums with a very staid and flat approach to how we're going to show things. You know, I also remember when Stephen Colbert's portrait was hung in the Smithsonian and they put it right above the bathroom, and it was sort of this hilarious thing about, you know, oh my God, there's a painting on top of the bathroom. And of course, a zillion people came because it was Stephen Colbert. But there is this extent to which we have these rules about how we design exhibits that really confine us and constrain us from going to a place that could be much more unusual, whether it's inviting people into an immersive space where they really are connected in a sensory way in lots of different ways, or whether it's about creating opportunities to have surprise, to have something that comes out of the floor, to have something surprising in the elevator. And I think that that kind of feeling lets people know, gosh, this place has something unusual for me, and it's not necessarily something that has to be provocative in a challenging way. It can be in a funny way. It can be in a welcoming way that kind of creates a sense of, oh, this place is playing with me, and I'm invited to play too.
When I hear some of the examples that you've given, I think, okay, I really understand how this works, say, in a museum where the art is there, because that kind of creativity and playfulness often comes into art as well. I'm wondering, though, I mean, a lot of your background and certainly some of the most innovative stuff when it comes to participatory museums came out of science and technology. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what's happening there and what you've taken from some of those examples into the Art and History Museum where you're running now.
Sure. Yeah, when I was a kid, absolutely, my dream job was to be an exhibit designer at the Exploratorium. And I think there are a lot of people who've had those kinds of experiences, whether it's in a children's museum or in a science center, that really have changed the way that they think about and engage with that kind of museum experience. And for me, actually, that's a very fundamental way I look at an art or a history museum. You know, when you walk into a science museum, when you walk into the Exploratorium, you are immediately hit with this message, which is, you can be a scientist, you can be an engineer, try it out, see what it's like. But when you walk into an art museum, you are not hit with, you can be an artist, you know, see what it's like. You're hit with a, you know, you can look at this art and maybe if you learn enough, you'll be able to understand why it's important. There's this real separation created. And so I think that in the same way that we talk about democratizing science and inviting people to really get involved in it, whether it's through an interactive exhibit or whether it's through a citizen science project where people are really engaged in doing serious science research as amateurs, I think we have to take that same kind of approach into art and history organizations so that we can do that kind of evangelism, really, to get people feeling that art is not something that somebody else does. History is not something somebody else did. It's something that you can be a part of as well.
Nina Simon is a great evangelist for museums and their potential. She is the executive director of the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History. And you can also find a link to her blog, Museum 2.0, at our website, yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, and I'm sitting in hosting Your Call for Rose Aguilar, who's going to be back on Monday. We want to hear from you, your experiences with museums, whether you felt included, excluded, excited, or thought, gosh, something better is possible here. I mean, talking with Nina before the program, you know, we're hoping to learn from you about your experiences. What's your great idea for making museums more welcoming, more participatory, more something that people don't feel like watching something on the wall, but they're actually part of creating a community space that's about learning? And when we come back, I want to ask you, Nina, you know, one of the ways that a lot of people experience museums for the first time is on a school tour. And you've in some ways described what you think the role of museum being as something it's really different from compulsory education as we know it. So I want to get your thoughts about that when we come back here on Your Call. You can also send us emails at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're talking about museums, what they are, what they could be, and we will be back right after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a show that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org. where you will also find links related to today's show. And that's where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. Just click the email newsletter link on the right side of the page. Again, that's at yourcallradio.org.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. Tomorrow, we're going to have our weekly media roundtable with Andrea Seabrook of Decode DC, Carrie Kahn, Mexico City correspondent for NPR, and also Michael McAuliffe of The Huffington Post. Going to be talking about the fiscal cliff and the new presidency in Mexico. Monday, we're going to be talking about, can California conserve its way out of its water crisis? So those are the topics coming up. Today, we are talking about the future of museums with Nina Simon, author of The Participatory Museum and creator of the blog Museum 2.0. She's also the executive director of the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History. And Nina, we have a lot of folks who are on the line wanting to talk to you. But just quickly, to explore that question of what the relationship is, I mean, you talk about this idea of museums being a place for free choice learning and how, in a way, that's an alternative to a lot of our education. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, that phrase was coined by a researcher named John Falk many years ago, 20, 30 years ago, when talking about what museums can really do. And, you know, when we think about all the research that's out there about learning, we know that schools are not equipped to cover the diverse ways that people learn. And I think that when a school group can come to a museum, it's an opportunity to have a different kind of experience, a kinesthetic experience, a materials-based experience. And it's really important to be able to look at those kinds of experiences, whether they happen in museums or other kinds of trips or connections that schools have, to expand how people can learn and how they can feel connected. We found at our museum that a lot of the projects we've done with schools, we've really tried to focus on inviting kids to learn about some art product or material, to make something, and then to have the work that they have created showcased at our museum, so that a kid can come into our museum and can say, wow, I made something, I learned how to do this, and I feel like I'm part of this as an artist. You know, I understand that there are lots of reasons to look at how we separate and talk about amateur versus professional artists. But for kids, and especially when arts funding has been so cut in our whole state, to really look at ways that we can invite kids to get that spark and to feel, again, not like it belongs to someone else, but that it's something that they can do, they can be proud of. And we've had lots of teachers say that they've been really surprised to see kids who are not blooming in other ways in classes really blossom through experiences that come through museum visits or through museum programs.
Hey, our phone lines are blossoming, so let's go and talk to Maria Louise, who's called in from Palo Alto. Welcome, Maria Louise.
Yes, good morning. And I'm so glad to hear this program and what Nina Simone is saying. It's I'm sorry, I hadn't turned off my radio.
You sound fine. Go ahead.
Echoed on you. So what I wanted to say was my daughter lives in San Francisco, and it's not like they have huge amounts of money, but she considered it so important for her three-year-olds to be able to visit museums, like Academy of Arts is probably their favorite, and also she also goes to the Young quite a lot. And so she has taken out memberships, and that is one way of encouraging oneself to go more often, and also to bring down the cost, you know. So I just wanted to mention that. It seems like a lot when you pay for the membership, but it pays for itself time and again. So that part's important, I think. And then my second point was I grew up in Sweden, and we had a lot of outages with schools. And one of the museums that we went to was enormous. And when we got in there, it was like entering another world and coming into many, many different times in history. So I have to say that it was just totally magic to come in there. And maybe there could have been a few more seats, yes. But anyway, so I think we should not underestimate the importance of museums for children, and I'm really glad of what I hear from Nina, because she sounds like the very right person for the place.
Thanks,
Marie-Louise. Thank you for the program.
Thank
you. Nina? Yeah, I want to appreciate so much, Marie-Louise, talking about membership. You know, when you become a member of a museum, especially one that obviously charges money, it completely changes your relationship with it because suddenly you can pop in over lunch and just spend 20 minutes looking at something that interests you, or you can come back again and again with your family and keep growing with the space. So I would really love to see museums move in a direction that is much more member-based, where the sense is not that you're going to visit once every 10 years, but that you're going to get involved and you're going to be coming back every week or every month. That for me, you know, we were talking earlier, Matt, about measures of success. And one of the things that's most important to me, you know, I don't really care that much if you come once. What I care about is if you come once and you get sparked to get more involved, to come again and again, to become a member, to become a volunteer, to say, hey, I'm a stone sculptor. Can I do something here with you? You know, and for us, especially being in a smaller community, there's this sense that we can do something that a giant museum that serves a million tourists a year can't, which is we can really build relationships through the museum with our visitors, and we really do that through membership.
Let's hear from Robert in San Francisco. Robert, welcome to your call.
Yes, hi. I just want to mention that I was a curator at the Legion of Honor and the De Young for 32 years, and so I have a kind of perspective. When I came to San Francisco in the 70s, the De Young and the Legion were free, and of course they're not now. And part of it is that the money dried up in terms of the city participation. The De Young and the Legion are both city museums, but they only get like 10 or 12% of their operating costs. And so if we had to rely on the city support, the museums would be closed 365 days a year. The sad truth is that these institutions are very, very expensive to maintain and to do the exhibitions and stuff. And one of the things that the De Young and the Legion try to do in terms of having a very active Friday night events for younger people and things like that, they also have a great outreach to younger students being able to come to the museum in school groups for free with docent training and all that. But just the actual cost of it, people say, well, you know, this is so expensive. And I think part of it's due that sometimes people go to Europe and museums like the National Gallery in London or the British Museum are free because they're state-sponsored or some other European museums, or they go to Washington and the National Gallery is free, and they think, well, why aren't our museums free? But the actual cost of keeping the doors open on these major institutions, and for that matter, a smaller institution like the one in Santa Cruz that your guest seems to be doing a wonderful job running, you're constantly trying to balance your mission, bringing art to the people, understanding the art, to having this, you talk about the fiscal cliff. Museums live with a fiscal cliff every year in terms of the cost involved, and I think people forget the fact that the museum is a very, very expensive place to run, and it's very, very difficult. The museum is not trying to make money. The museum is just trying to get close to breaking even each year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's a huge issue. And actually, you know, the other story of success for us in terms of turnaround has been financial. You know, over the last year and a half, or I guess in the first year I was there, we both increased our attendance by more than 100%. But we also went from being in the red for several years to being in the black for the first time. And one of the things I've found, and one of the things I've been curious about, is saying, okay, what if we were to really push on this idea that we are going to be a place that is of, by, and for our community, and we are going to be as welcoming and really as supportive of the diverse people in our community as possible? What could that mean about different funding opportunities that exist for something that is not seen anymore as an elite art institution? I really sympathize with and understand the huge financial costs. You know, at one point we talked even at our museum about maybe instead of admission, we could sort of say to people, here's how much it costs today to do X. But frankly, it costs $2,500 a day to keep our museum open, and we couldn't get the numbers small enough that it wouldn't be just absolutely daunting. Disappointing. Yeah, exactly. On the other hand, I do think that there is a real slippery slope here. You know, when you look at organizations like symphony orchestras or operas, one of the reasons those organizations are seen as incredibly elitist is because their ticket prices are so high. And yet they would say exactly the same thing. It costs so much to put these things on. We're not getting the support we need. We lose money even when we sell tickets. Well, you know what? If you lose money when you sell tickets, you should find another way to support that or replace that revenue. The Dallas Museum of Art just made an announcement that they are going completely free and going to free memberships in the coming year in 2013 because they want to change their relationship with the community. And that is a very big museum. There are lots of absolute financial issues that come with these things, and free admission is actually quite complex in a lot of ways. But I do think that we have to think about how can we really support the work that we want to do, as opposed to saying, okay, you know, here are the buckets of money, and what does this mean about what we have to charge?
So is part of the battle that you see for the participatory museum and accessibility about that question of public funding? I mean, that's Robert brought that up, and it seems to me you don't make that a big part of your message, or maybe I just haven't heard it.
Well, I think it's an important part, but boy, is that a long game. And I think it's amazing that on a national level, the American Association, I'm sorry, they're now called the American Alliance of Museums, they've really made advocacy a key part of their message. And but, you know, arts funding on a national level, particularly in the U.S., is very grim. And so it's hard to really figure out how can that public funding conversation happen. I will say that locally in Santa Cruz, even though our county is struggling financially, the argument for public funding for the museum has really changed. Now that all of those boards of supervisors or city council can look at the museum, can say, this is a place that is doing community development. It's helping with economic development. It's bringing people together across social division. It's tackling some of the big issues. It makes it a heck of a lot easier for them to even consider public support if you can do more than say, we're an arts institution and we have terrific stuff and you should support that.
Nina Simon, we got an email from Chuck who says, there are second-tier social media sites that feature art. In addition to the usual attractions of social media, most allow artists or would-be artists to display their work, and it becomes possible to make personal connections as well. He says, I'm an amateur photographer. I use such a site. My work is nowhere near museum quality, but I see others that are very good. We're able to look at great art and not so great art, chat with artists, and foster cooperation and appreciation for each other. And I guess what that brings to mind for me is museums are working in a really different kind of context. People, to get people to see their art, for instance, don't necessarily have to have a curator say yes to it. How does that change your responsibility?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about that story, too, is that he really focuses on the conversations that happen around the objects. And when I often think about artifacts in museums, I think about this idea of how could we make them social objects? You know, and for me, the best example of this is a dog, right? If you have a dog and you're out walking the streets, people will talk to you because of the dog. And they're not so much talking to you, you know, they're sort of talking through the dog to you. And the
if the dog were alone, they wouldn't talk to the dog.
Right, exactly. Well, I hope not. Yeah. But the dog mediates a conversation that wouldn't otherwise happen. And that's the same thing that's happening on lots of social media sites, whether it's talking about photography, whether it's talking about guitars you collect, whether it's just talking about Facebook status updates. And I think one of the challenges we have in museums is to say, how can we make our artifacts more like dogs? How can we invite people to really have active conversations around the artwork or the objects or the stories on display? I think, unfortunately, sometimes that idea of museum quality creates a damper that makes people not feel comfortable saying, hey, I like this, or hey, what do you think about this, or whoa, this one's crazy, because they feel like somebody else has vetted all this stuff and has said, this is of a certain quality, and you're here to appreciate it. You're not here to have these discussions and these arguments around it. There was once one of the projects I love from a small museum in England in Worcester. They did a project once called Top 40, where they took 40 paintings from their collection and they hung them up. Very simple exhibition. But then they put a ballot box in the middle of the room and they said to people, vote for your favorite painting to go up in the rankings. And they had these numbers from 1 to 40. And every Friday night they would count up all the ballots and they would move around the numbers based on how people had voted. And what this created was this whole conversation going on in the community about how we think about art relative to each other. What's good? What do we like? Why do we like it? And what they found was that people would come in and they'd stand by their favorite paintings and lobby, you know, to other visitors in the museum and say, you know, this one really deserves your vote. And it really created a conversation, the kinds of conversations we're having on social media and the kinds of conversations, unfortunately, that many people don't feel invited to have in museums.
We're having a conversation about museums and their future with Nina Simon, author of The Participatory Museum, executive director of the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History. You're welcome to join that conversation. Give your ideas for making museums more active, more participatory, more part of the community. Or maybe, hey, there's a museum as it is right now that you love and you say, don't change it a bit. What's your reflection on this? What do you think of Nina Simon's ideas and what she is advocating? 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Millie in Berkeley. Millie, welcome to Your Call.
Hello, thank you very much. I'm very interested in and very accepting of the idea of a participatory museum, But I want to argue for the importance of awe and wonder in a museum. I grew up in Washington, D.C., where museums were free, and there was the gorgeous National Gallery. We called it the Mellon then, because Andrew Mellon had given so much money that it was free. And it was made of the most gorgeous marble and cool floors and beautiful vistas. Then there's also the Smithsonian, where you could go in most any door for free, I think. I don't know, but I think
yes,
so.
Yes, you can, absolutely.
And it's the rotunda in the middle. When you, at one stage, they put in an African elephant charging across the rotunda. And it was its trunk was up, and its legs were in the air, and it really looked like an elephant coming at you. It was just glorious. And I think awe is an important feature of a museum.
Millie,
thank you.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for calling. Nina?
Yeah, and I absolutely agree with you, Millie. And I guess what I would say is that I think of participatory experiences as an and not an or for museums. I think that we need spaces in museums for lots of different things, for contemplation, for awe and wonder, for learning, and also for participation. And I think that it can be in some museums, meaning bringing in a space like a creativity zone or a studio space. It can mean inviting people to be part of one project but not another. It doesn't need to be something that's pervasive throughout the space. One thing I am curious about, though, and I think we're starting to play with in Santa Cruz, is this question of what happens if you have a museum that is wholly participatory? And in some ways, you could almost imagine it being like Frank Oppenheimer asking the question, what happens if you create a science museum that is all hands-on and interactive? And I think it's possible that we may go in a direction where there are some museums, a few, that are wholly participatory, but that for the most part, participatory techniques get woven into bigger museums as just one part of the different things they do and not necessarily something that becomes overshadowing of their whole experience.
But I mean, in a world where most people who are under a certain age are carrying around their smartphones with them everywhere they go. And where that idea of saying, oh, I like this painting and I'm going to take a picture and post it to my Facebook page so people know what I'm doing right now, but that's more the norm than the exception. I mean, is it going to be important actually to carve out the quiet contemplative spaces instead of to say, here's the active zone?
Maybe, Matt, but boy, are we so far from that. You know, when people ask me, well, what about the traditional museum? I say to them, you know what? You can go to 99% of 99% of museums, and they will be that traditional model. Museums are slow-moving beasts, and I think that it's amazing when museums innovate in any way, and it always happens along the fringe, and I hope that we continue to move forward in really figuring out lots of different ways museums can exist. I think the problem happens when museums say, you know what? We're going to just ignore this phenomenon, for example, of people using their phones all the time or wanting to take pictures or wanting to talk, and we're just going to clamp in our heels and say, you know what, we are this traditional solve and this pushback against what's happening in modern culture. I mean, I think that's not only wrong-headed in terms of trying to reach audiences, but it's also a little offensive. You know, there's a huge issue around mobile phone use in art museums and this question of whether it's a good idea to let people take photos of the art. And I've talked to some museum people who've said, you know what, it's so lovely when somebody brings a sketchbook into a museum and wants to work on something related to an artwork, but it drives me crazy when people walk through with their eyes behind the camera the whole time. And I say to them, you know what, those are just two different media to do the same thing, to capture an experience, to be able to process it in some way, to share it in some way. And we can't be so segregationist in terms of saying this kind of tool is good, but that kind of tool is bad. We have to really look at how do audiences want to engage? What do we see in the research about what they learn from or experience based on the engagement they have? And then pick tools that we want to support based on that.
I want to go to hear from Mike in Santa Cruz. Mike, welcome to your call. Well, maybe we lost Mike. Let's go to Jeff, also from Santa Cruz.
Hello.
Welcome to your call.
Can you hear me?
Ken, you're loud and clear. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Hey, Nina. My name is Jeff Traugott. I'm a guitar maker here in Santa Cruz, and there's been a bunch of talk about getting a guitar exhibit going in Santa Cruz because we have a ton of local guitar makers.
Yeah.
And compile that with a bunch of great local musicians. And I'm wondering, how do you go about talking to you about these kinds of exhibits? In other words, contacting you, or how does one go about getting in touch to try to propose an idea for the museum?
Call or email or just walk in the door anytime. We have all of our contact information on staff posted on our website, santacruzma.org. We also have a comment board that is the first thing you see when you walk in the museum. And when people answer the question, how can we improve the museum, and they put their email address, we get right back to them. We love hearing ideas that people have and working with them on it. I think also, you know, for us, if we are going to be a place that really serves this community, we have to know what's on people's minds and what they want to see. And that doesn't mean always doing exactly the thing if somebody says, you know, I want to see XYZ, but it does mean taking those opportunities and really finding what's out there in our community. I think for us, one of the most powerful examples last year was the GLOW Festival of Fire and Light, where a local guy, Steve Cooper, came to me and he said, you know what, we have some of the best fire artists in Santa Cruz anywhere in the world, but they can never show their work locally because of all the fire restrictions, and they only get to do so at Burning Man. So we worked for months with the fire department and with these artists to be able to create this amazing festival in downtown Santa Cruz to showcase this incredible artistry that doesn't fit into a typical museum and, frankly, should probably never be inside a museum given the height of the flames that were coming out. But that's the kind of thing where a community member coming forward and saying, hey, here's this amazing thing going on. Let's find a way to work together to make this happen. That makes our job easier because we know that we're working with people who are invested and we know that there's an audience built in that's excited about the work.
Let's hear from Harvey, who's called in at 866-798-8255. Harvey, welcome to your call.
Hi, thanks. You know, I don't have much substantive to say about the conversation you've had, but the sense of wonder that the lady from Palo Alto had commented about is really, really true. In my case, it was seeing Diego Rivera's mural at the Detroit Institute of Arts. I was just immersed in it, and it was fabulous, waiting for my sister to finish her art class as a little kid. That gave me this love of art that I've had for a long, long time. And for my son, who will probably be talking to you soon, it was seeing these Viking artifacts in the museum in Göteborg, Sweden. And I had to drag him in, but once he saw these wonderful artifacts displayed in a mysterious way, he just loved it, and it involved him. So all the things that you folks are doing really to involve people is a marvelous thing. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Harvey. Nina, we had a number of calls of people saying words, you know, like awe and magic and things being glorious. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's, for some people, like, that is what they see as, like, this is the core value of a museum. It's why you'd argue mm-hmm. that, yes, tax money should go to this, because there are so few places, experiences that offer you something like that. I mean, how would you kind of respond to that as the core idea of what's valuable there? And what's the thing you'd say, here's what's essential about this kind of participatory vision, you know, that just is important to support?
Yeah, I think the awe and the glory and that absolute feeling of wonder is so essential. And many of us, those are the key moments we think of. But if you talk to people, especially people who live in smaller municipalities or rural areas, that awe and wonder probably happened from one family visit they did to Washington, D.C., or to New York, or San Francisco, or Detroit. You know, it's something that happened once and was a catalyzing experience. But that doesn't necessarily mean when they get back home, they're going to look for the small local art, history, science museum and get involved with that. You know, if you look at the vast majority of museums in this country, think about any time you're driving down the road and you see a sign that says museum exit here or historical society. Most museums in our country are small places that may not have those awesome, glorious objects that we associate with the great museums of the world. And that's not to say those awesome objects aren't important, because they absolutely are. But we need to find a way to make a connection between that and something that people can experience every day or every week. You know, my dream is that people, yes, will have those awesome experiences, but will also have a museum or a cultural center that they can stop in every day. You know, Starbucks has created a situation where people really feel like it's a good idea for them to spend 15 minutes in a coffee shop every day and spend a little bit of money doing so. Imagine if we could do the same thing for art or for science, this sense that, oh, this is a part of my day, it's a part of my life, and I think that that can be punctuated by awesome experiences, but that's not the sole experience. I think also it's very interesting you talk about public funding with this. There's been some really interesting research about how to support public funding for the arts. And one of the things that's been discovered is that many arts organizations will use that basic idea of, you know, spiritual uplift or showcasing the glory of a community to say, here's why you should support this. And that argument doesn't hold up when you talk to people on the street or when you talk to politicians. What they found does hold up is to be able to say, these art experiences or these institutions create ripple effects throughout our community. Some of them are very explicit, economic development arguments, educational arguments. Some of them are less explicit, giving people something inspirational as part of their day, connecting them to somebody who's not like them. And I think that we have to sometimes get beyond the ideas and the arguments that are so internalized for people who are already art lovers to really think about how can we make sure that people feel like cultural institutions are really important thing for public funding, the same way we think about schools or cops or any kind of planning elements that happen in a city.
Nina, I want to. We're a little short on time. I want to bring in one last caller who's called in, Heather in Alameda. If you could be brief, Heather, just go right to the point. We'd love to have you on the show. Welcome.
Okay. I want us to talk about the UC Botanical Garden, which is a living museum, plants of the Mediterranean, climates all around the world. They're free the first Thursday of the month, and they have docent programs. Kids come in, study crops of the Americas and the California native peoples and plants. Also, the Crucible, which is a nonprofit industrial fine arts school where you can go and learn to do stuff. You go and you start working in the first classes. Rick Turner, who's a luthier, I guess they're called. I learned how to make a mandolin in 2 weekends. He's from Santa Cruz. But the Crucible is having an open house this weekend. You can come in and look around. They have short classes where people can take in 3 hours, learn, attempt to do something if they're interested in blacksmithing or glass fusing or glass blowing.
Heather? Thank you so much for calling in, both the UC Berkeley Botanical Gardens and the Crucible, some great Bay Area resources. Final thoughts from you, Nina Simon.
I think Heather's talking about, it's a great vision to imagine a museum as a space for making, as a space for experiencing something awesome, as a space for connecting with somebody who's new to you. And I would just invite anybody, if you want to come down to Santa Cruz, our museum is open every Friday night till 9 p.m. with lots of different kinds of programming, hands-on experiences, as well as terrific exhibitions. It's a great way to be introduced to what we're doing, and we really invite anybody, wherever you are, go out and experience a museum in a new way. Feel okay laughing or yelling or pointing at something that excites you. Feel okay having a conversation there. Make it your place and make it a place for your community.
Well, Nina Simon, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your vision and what you're doing at the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History. Nina Simon's the author of The Participatory Museum and also creator of the blog Museum 2.0. If you found any part of this conversation interesting, I really recommend go to Museum 2.0, check out what Nina's writing about there. I think you'll find it well worth your time. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on Your Call, and I'll be back in a moment to let you know what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the budget and tax standoff between Republicans and President Obama. We'll ask Decode DC's Andrea Seabrook and the Huffington Post's Michael McAuliffe who's doing reporting that takes us beyond the official narratives. Mexico has a new president from an old party, the PRI's Enrique Peña Nieto. We'll hear from NPR's Carrie Kahn about the nationwide protests following his inauguration. It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.